I agree entirely that nothing should be holy, and openness to new ideas is, I think, fundamental to human progress.
Welcome to the Case for Conservation podcast, where we explore and sometimes interrogate topics in the field of conservation and the environment more broadly. I'm your host, Andre Marder. There's a tendency in societies to adhere to conventional wisdom. We tend to resist challenges to consensus views and may even dismiss those who challenge them as conspiracy theorists, which sometimes they turn out to be. But perhaps we take that idea a bit too far sometimes. Perhaps we underestimate the importance of the freedom to challenge orthodoxy. We live in an age in which more people than ever before are lucky enough to inhabit free societies. But recently it's become conventional to take issue with some of these hard-earned freedoms, albeit often with good intentions. Even people who don't follow the news cycle must be familiar with concepts like cancel culture and deplatforming. In this episode, we discuss the notion of questioning orthodoxy, with a focus on the environment and especially conservation. My guest is Russell Galt, Head of Policy and Science at Earthwatch Europe, and previously Senior Program Coordinator at IUCN's work on urban conservation, and Young Champions of the Earth Coordinator with the United Nations Environment Programme. Russell recently completed a Master of Business Administration at the University of Edinburgh to complement his existing expertise in ecology. Russell is an old friend of mine, and I've always appreciated his frankness and thoughtfulness. We were planning to discuss the phenomena of echo chambers and filter bubbles and how they affect conservation thinking. But I subsequently discovered that, at least according to the literature, they affect only a small portion of society, and they might not be as big a deal as I thought they were. I'll keep watching that space as the research continues, but meanwhile, we do touch on the topic briefly in this episode, and it is quite relevant to what we discuss here. This was more of a conversation and less of an interview than perhaps any previous episodes, but Russell certainly lived up to the expectations I had of him as an insightful and thought-provoking conversation partner. Our recording starts with him talking about how some important thinkers have been dismissed in the past for challenging orthodox views.
If you look throughout history, many of the major leaps forward have been due to imagination. Right the way back to Galileo, who was famously placed under house arrest, I believe, you know, for the last 10 years of his life because he claimed that the solar system was heliocentric. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, Nikola Tesla, who had the famous war of currents with Thomas Edison and was widely regarded as something of a reclusive weirdo. And yet, you know, today many of his ideas have come into fruition about wireless energy transmission and so forth. Mm-hmm. Charles Darwin, another one worth mentioning. I think he was certainly a heretic in his day, fiercely resisted by the church and others, even the wider scientific community. And indeed, Jane Goodall, who broke all the protocols and decided to live among the chimpanzees at Gombe Stream National Park. Mm-hmm. And decided to give the chimpanzees individual names like people and sit among them. And by taking this rather unorthodox approach, she was able to identify patterns in their behavior, the complex social behaviors of chimpanzees, and acquire the sort of knowledge and insights that would hitherto have been impossible. And she was ridiculed by her contemporaries. I think she studied, was it animal behavior at Cambridge eventually? But anyway, she was ridiculed. And then some years later, she was, of course, vindicated, even celebrated. And then more recently, of course, there are the likes of Bjorn Lomborg, somewhat polemic character. I don't believe he's a climatologist, though, is he? He's a political scientist who weighs in on the development agenda from time to time.
Yeah.
And then there's another chap, Rupert Sheldrake, who I'm busily reading his book, in fact, called The Science Delusion. And he sets out 10 dogmas, or let's say widely held scientific principles, and he questions each one of them. He dedicates a chapter to each of them. And some of them are really interesting, you know, like the laws of nature are fixed throughout the universe. And he said, well, are they? You know, is there any evidence to that, or are they forever evolving? Mm-hmm. And then he basically draws attention to the gaping omissions in our scientific knowledge base and suggest, well, we should at the very least be open to the possibilities of alternative explanations. And his major concern in the book, I've only read half of it, but his major concern is that the scientific worldview, far from being conducive to intellectual enlightenment and advancement, he suggests that the scientific worldview is now so dogmatic that it's constraining the freedom of thinking, the swirling of ideas, you know, the cross-pollination that we need in order to make those big leaps forward in the future. So yeah, throughout history, there have been many, many contrarian thinkers. Even Einstein, I believe, used to dream up his theories long before he ever put pen to paper and calculated them using cold-hearted mathematics. So imagination is so important. And I think imagination is definitely under threat nowadays as well. I think it's fair to say that children, at least, are living less and less imaginative lives, more and more screen time.
I just wanted to pick up on what you said about questioning, because and also about science, because we still have incredible freedom of speech in the Western world, but there's no doubt that there have been challenges to that freedom of speech. And I think that I don't know how much it affects it, but I think that the two are linked. That and what I have noticed in the scientific literature recently, which seems to be a kind of a, I mean, as you, like you were saying, dogma, you know, the dogma seems to be affecting the way things are going. And this paper that I shared with you, which I've actually discussed on the podcast before, which myself and some colleagues published recently, I think is quite a good example. It was looking at the links between land use change, land cover change, and the risk of zoonotic disease spillover. I think you've had a look at this, right, Russell?
So you, absolutely.
To me, the most kind of unsettling outcome or result of that was, and perhaps part of the reason why it was accepted for publication in that journal, was that the science, I mean, so it's not surprising that the media, you know, grabs onto a particular idea and runs with it and gives people a fairly one-sided view of things. But what kind of surprised me was that the secondary science, in other words, the commentary in peer-reviewed journals, that secondary science was giving a very similar message to what the media was giving, which was basically that land change almost inevitably results in increased spillover risk of zoonotic disease. But then you go back to the empirical research, the primary research, and there's nothing near consensus on that. There are plenty of exceptions. There are plenty of mixed cases. And then, of course, there are all the file drawer problem studies, the many studies that wouldn't have been published because they didn't come up with any significant results, which would have further watered down the idea that land change is an inevitable cause of spillover risk. So I'm not saying, as I mentioned in the podcast and in the paper, we're not saying that land change doesn't cause spillover risk. What we're saying is that it doesn't inevitably cause it, and that there are many situations in which could have even the opposite effect. So sorry to go into so much detail about one particular example, but the point was that, you know, just over 50% of empirical studies say something, but then 70 or 80% of the commentary and 99% or 98% of the media reports are saying something. So this amplification of a supposed consensus, by the time it reaches the public, it's completely unidirectional and therefore, I think, giving completely the wrong impression to people, you know?
Absolutely. And I myself am guilty of having done that. I've written an article in which I suggested that COVID-19 is not the first zoonotic disease thought to have been triggered by ecological disturbance. And I referred to the Ebola virus, which is named after a river in the Congo Basin, and even the Zika virus, which is a forest. Zika is a forest in Uganda. So I'm guilty of having fallen into that trap. And I understand, as ever, with ecology and biology, the truth is always a little nuanced. There are exceptions. And I think that's a real value you've brought to this agenda, to this debate, through your paper and through the podcast. So I'm thinking about the gray literature, and I think a lot of the falsehoods, or let's say exaggerations, unqualified exaggerations, tend to appear in the gray literature. And that there are these apparent facts that are floated around, and you see them on the websites of reputable organizations. Just recently, I was writing about fresh water quality and its decline across Britain. And I saw on the Wildlife Trust's website, which is a very respectable UK NGO, one of the biggest, in fact. And on the website, it said that Britain had lost, I think, 90% of its wetlands in the past century. And I couldn't find the original source anywhere. And then I started to think about it. And thought, that's a lot of wetland to lose in just a century. And it doesn't seem to add up. And I couldn't find the original source anywhere. So I suspect it might have been one of these, I don't know, presentations or perhaps a media article, and it's just been passed around the conservation sector like a Chinese whisper. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, you know, that is not an isolated case. I think there are many, many such cases where figures that may have been born out of dubious science or even hearsay are picked up enthusiastically, often with good intentions, right, by the conservation sector and passed around. And I think this example of increased risk of zoonotic disease transmission resulting from the degradation of natural areas, we were rather too quick to jump on that bandwagon and to use it to our advantage in the conservation sector.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things I worry about is the credibility that could be lost by doing that. You know, if it turns out one day that land change has nothing to do with COVID-19. And I suspect, and I have spoken about this on the podcast before a little bit, but I suspect that a lot of the alarmist environmental messages that we've been giving over the decades, you know, it's quite a feature of environmental communication, right? Is these quite extreme, quite strong messages, many of which have turned out to be wrong. And I think that, and I'm entirely guilty of this myself, you know, throughout my career of, as I say, regurgitating those messages and without really much question. But so many of them have turned out to be wrong. And Paul Ehrlich has an entire litany of examples, you know, these sort of trails behind him. I shouldn't pick on individuals like that, but he is quite a major offender in that sense. And I really, the thing is that we don't have a measure of how much harm that's done to the environmental movement, broadly speaking.
Sure.
We simply don't know. Maybe nothing, but I suspect a hell of a lot, actually.
Did you see, was it just last week or the week before, Al Gore was giving this impassioned speech at the World Economic Forum in Davos. Mm-hmm. And he's a wonderful speaker, a wonderful orator. He fired up the crowd, and he was actually reprimanding the international community for having not done enough. Mm-hmm. But in his speech, he included the rather dubious term, oceans boiling. The oceans are boiling. Now, any sensible adult would know it was an exaggeration. It was a metaphor, mm-hmm. okay? But of course, the media pounced on that and said, oh, these climate sensationalists and undermined him. We have to be very careful with our language. Mm-hmm. So that is certainly one school of thought. But then there's another argument which says, hold on a minute. We're trying to fight this war to save life on Earth using little puny truth sticks. Some of our enemies are using the wildest lies, you know? And I think of the nonsense around the medicinal value of some of these rare and endangered animals. For example, rhino horn, that's meant to increase virility in men. Mm-hmm. And we're trying to convey this very sober messaging to diminish the demand, and it's not working. It's clearly not working. Rhinos are still being poached at a horrendous rate across sub-Saharan Africa. So are we missing a trick here? If we're fighting lies, should we not be using lies? And this is just a thought experiment. I'm not necessarily supporting mm-hmm. this, but would it be more effective if we launched a campaign, if the conservation community got together and launched a massive campaign in Southeast Asia or wherever the rhino horn is in high demand and said, actually, it does the opposite. There's evidence to show that it causes erectile dysfunction. Therefore, we should not be consuming rhino horn, something just as mm-hmm. wild and unfounded and wacky. You know, would that be a fair and defensible strategy to use in the interests of conservation? Because it feels like sometimes the forces against us in our effort to save life on Earth, they're not prepared just to stick to the truth. Mm-hmm. They're using every wild and wacky idea at their disposal. And so there's a mismatch. It's not a level playing field. This is just a thought experiment. I want to be very clear. I work for Earthwatch, and we are committed to science as much as any organization. But it's something perhaps worth considering in certain circumstances, particularly when you're working with people who are themselves not familiar with science, people whose worldview may be one steeped in superstition and religion and not necessarily amenable to scientific reason, at least, you know, in the case of something like rhino horn.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, apart from what I said about credibility, which I think is a key part of the answer to that question, I think that the truth is robust. No matter how mixed up things get, you can kind of always find the truth again, because the truth is constant, right?
Sure.
So the truth has this kind of elastic quality to it. And I think that it's simply the safest bet to stick to the truth, even if it doesn't wow people, you know? And I think maybe just another component to that is that we should give people a little bit more credit. We shouldn't think of ourselves too much as their guides and their teachers and their moral superiors, but rather to, you know, state the facts and stick to the facts, and just relentlessly stick to the facts and trust them to kind of follow to some extent. And that's very general and very vague, and it differs across cultures and societies and all the rest of it. But I do think that that's kind of, you know, the base that we have to keep on coming back to.
Absolutely. But would you agree that we also should make better use of behavioral science? And sometimes that means we have to round up numbers. We have to simplify our messaging. I mean, there are so many directions this conversation could move in, but I think of the need of every human to make shortcuts, mental shortcuts, in order just to navigate the world and get through the day. You know, I wouldn't get out of the house in the morning if I didn't make some assumptions. Yes, that the floor is solid, I'm not going to plunge into quicksand, or that the window is solid, I can't walk through it. You know, I don't need to go through a process of experimentation at every juncture in order to navigate through this world. I need to rely on some assumptions. And then I think of behavioral science and how we as a conservation community, I think, have largely neglected it. And we're trying to bring about change. And we are mostly ecologists or biologists, and we are sticklers for the truth. But sometimes we can borrow, I think, from behavioral science to round up numbers. And one great example I often refer to is that of the Dutch forester, Cecil Koninginnedijk. I hope I pronounced that correctly. Anyway, he came up with this idea when pushed, when he was asked how many trees should every city aspire to have. He said, well, I would like to put forward the 330-300 rule. Okay, every house should see three trees from the window. Every city should be at least 30% canopy cover. And every citizen should live within 300 meters of a green space, high quality green space. Okay, it's very simple. And there's a symmetry to that rule of thumb, 330, 300. Now this, unlike many other scientific doctrines and people who are sharing scientific advice on how cities should be calibrated with nature, this has spread like wildfire. There are now donors that are embedding it in their in their templates, saying that, okay, we're looking for NGOs to help cities realize this 330-300 rule. Now, is it grounded in science? Well, probably it's more of practice than science. Is it scientifically defensible? Well, if you look at behavioral science and your ultimate goal is to affect change in cities, then absolutely it's scientifically defensible. And in the scientific community, I've noticed this a lot as well when I previously worked at IUCN. We are sticklers for truth, but we're missing a few tricks here. And I think if we work increasingly like psychologists or some people in the marketing world, you know, who are adept at capturing and moving hearts and minds, I think we'd be more effective actually as a sector. And it may mean that we have to compromise here and there on a precise number for the purpose of finding traction. I mean, think of 1.5 degrees Celsius or 2 degrees Celsius climate warming, or the headline, we've got 10 years to fix the climate system. I think it's now 8, actually, rather worrying, or maybe even 6, rapidly diminishing. But, you know, these numbers are, they're not quite plucked out of thin air, but they have resonance and value. And for that purpose, I think they are perfectly valid because they're designed to achieve change. Do you agree?
Yeah, no, it's a really good question. I don't have a very good answer, but I guess that my substandard answer would be that there's a real range of malpractice out there when it comes to using figures. And that 3,300 example, which that's a suggested method, right, which is based on science. But let me give you an example of something which might be at the other end of the spectrum. I'm very keen to speak to someone about this, possibly for the next episode of the podcast, actually. Have you heard that we're expected to lose, I think it's 99% of corals within the next few decades, if I remember correctly? And I should have looked up the exact figures. I'll put them in the podcast description.
I remember I think it's the UNEP or perhaps UNFCCC slide, and it showed three scenarios. And the worst case scenario is we lose 99% by, I don't know, 2050. But it's with a certain amount of warming, which I think might have been 2.5 degrees Celsius. I'll look it up now whilst we're talking.
So I guess this is one of the things that happens is that you get scenarios are I think very often the culprits. I mean, of course, scenarios are critical, but very often, you know, the scenarios, depending on, it's a case of cherry picking, right? You can cherry pick the scenario that fits your narrative best. But this coral example in particular, I just wanted to bring up because I also heard recently that the Great Barrier Reef, you know, the world's largest coral reef, is currently, the Australian government did a survey recently, quite an extensive survey. You know, they had divers out doing transects for months. So it's really a thorough survey. And one of their conclusions was the reef is in the best condition that it has been in the last 30 years. So it's been improving over time. And so one possible reason for this is that the corals that are growing are the faster growing corals. The slower growing corals could be, you know, the species diversity of slower growing corals could be going down quite fast, whereas the faster growing ones are taking over, which is not necessarily a good thing. But I'd like to understand how to reconcile these two glaringly. Of course, the Great Barrier Reef is just one reef, but it is the biggest in the world. So if things are going so well there, then certainly the 99% cannot be correct. So this kind of thing, you know, I think we just need to get our story straight enough. I completely agree that you need to have pithy messages and figures, but there's, I guess sometimes it just gets taken a bit too far, and that can really backfire on conservation because we do have real problems, right? We have plenty of enormous problems. And I just worry that that exaggeration is something that can really come back to bite us.
I agree. And I think I've got the slide in front of me now, and it's 1.5 degrees Celsius will result in 70 to 90% of coral reefs vanishing.
Okay.
But with 2 degrees Celsius of warming, we would see 99% of coral reefs vanishing.
What's the date that they give there?
It doesn't even give a date.
Okay.
You know, so it's very vague. And that was published, I think, by the UNFCCC.
Yeah.
Another stat that just came to mind whilst you were speaking is this one that's been bandied around about us only having 60 harvests left. Have you heard that? With current rates of soil loss.
No, that's new to me.
Very, very alarming. So apparently with current rates of soil loss globally, we only have 60 harvests left. That's terrifying. That would instill fear in anyone, particularly in a child that will still be around in 60 years. Mm-hmm. So I suspect that is also something of an exaggeration. And indeed, I did try to find the original source, and it was, you know, some anecdotal comment made by someone, I think, at some conference years ago, mm-hmm. but without any, you know, peer-reviewed scientific literature behind mm-hmm. it. So this is a comment which is, it's a statistic which is incredible and yet valuable for the conservation movement to drum up fear. But what you're suggesting is actually counter to that. Mm-hmm. You're suggesting this is unhelpful, it's counterproductive. And in fact, what we're doing is creating scope for skepticism and actually shooting ourselves in the foot.
Yeah. And like I said, we don't know how much harm, you know, this is not a new thing in the environmental movement, I use that word broadly speaking, but we have been doing it for a very long time, you know, going back long before our careers started. There was kind of alarmist rhetoric and frightening figures that were put out there. And I don't know if it's possible to measure. I don't know if anyone's really tried to measure the harm that's done, but it may be extreme. You know, it may have done more harm than good. Maybe if the environmental movement and environmental science and practitioners had just doggedly used the truth as a North Star, even when they knew it wasn't going to convince people, maybe by now we would have made incredible progress. Maybe, you know, the whole of society, left and right, would have been on board. We just don't know, right?
There's no counterfactual.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I think on extinction, I mean, we've barely scratched the surface, and we're burning the Book of Life before we've even read it. And I often think about extinction risk. Risk itself is very, very difficult to quantify. Mm-hmm. And especially now when we live in this world of potential nuclear escalation. And I was chatting to a very senior conservation professional over the weekend about nuclear war. Mm-hmm. And asking the question, should we as conservationists who have dedicated our careers to conserving life on Earth not be far more concerned about nuclear proliferation mm-hmm. and the prospect of a miscalculation that could lead ultimately to a decadal nuclear winter mm-hmm. and make life terribly uncomfortable on Earth? And I would imagine then, you know, all our hard conserved pandas and goodness knows what else would evaporate. Mm-hmm. And I think we're not giving nearly enough concern to the issue of global peace. Again, my personal opinion, but I think nuclear war is a far greater threat to life on Earth than climate change or rapacious economies. Mm-hmm. I think nuclear war is now a serious, serious threat to our entire biosphere, the ecosphere. And we as the conservation sector should be much, much more outspoken in contesting it. Not an easy one to solve, though. There are people who have lived much longer than me and dedicated their entire lives to non-proliferation and made little headway, unfortunately.
But, you know, there are other things to be concerned about. And I think that and nuclear war may well be the biggest potential threat and the biggest potential risk. But something, again, which kind of motivates my kind of quest to speak to people and to kind of dig into conventional wisdom a bit, is that I think that conservation, the environmental movement in general, and conservation as one example, tend not to look at the bigger picture sufficiently. And you just gave one very good example there, right? Like nuclear war doesn't feature in conservation plans or climate plans. But also, if we want the greatest possible good for the greatest possible number of people and for nature, you've got to think about a whole bunch of different factors and not do things purely because you're an environmentalist, therefore you've kind of got to take the environmental solutions. And nature-based solutions is a term that's coming up a lot these days, and it's kind of a perhaps a more general and wide-ranging way of expressing what was focused on in the past was ecosystem-based adaptation, right? And in the case of ecosystem-based adaptation or nature-based solutions, very often the assumption within our conservation world is that, you know, you might get donor funding to do a project. The assumption from the very beginning of the project is that the nature-based solution is the best possible solution, and all that we need to do is to figure out how to implement it. Whereas for the communities involved, which have to be the first consideration, that might not necessarily be, I mean, hopefully it is, but that might not necessarily be the best solution. So I would say the first step is to find out, if we're conservationists, find out where are nature-based solutions the best solutions, and then focus our efforts there, because that's where we're going to be honest about, you know, doing the greatest possible good that we can.
A few points on NBS. I think one of the criteria put forth by IUCN and its global standard for nature-based solutions mm-hmm. actually does require community consultation, uh-huh. free and informed consent, and almost co-design. I don't recall the precise wording, but it does take into account the aspirations and needs of the local community. And there's also another principle or criterion, which is to balance ecological and economic trade-offs consciously rather than haphazardly. Mm-hmm, okay. But I think, you know, the general point is correct, that, you know, nature isn't always the solution to everything. And in the conservation sector, well, because we fought so hard for so long just to be heard, and now we're getting heard. And we work really hard just to hammer home the message that nature never rusts, that nature can fix this, can fix that. But you know, there are some instances I'm aware of, certainly in the global south, having lived in Kenya and South Africa, where, you know, sometimes urban nature isn't desirable. You know, if you live in a biodiverse country in the tropics, you don't necessarily want snakes crawling around your garden. You don't necessarily want mosquitoes infesting your house. You know, the relationship with nature is very different. And similarly, there are problems associated with crime, increased likelihood of crime, if you live near to a green space where people can hide. And even in the UK, at Earthwatch Europe, we're involved in what's called tiny forest planting. It's an initiative that we started in lockdown, before I joined, in fact. And more often than not, these tennis court-sized tiny forests are welcomed, and we engage the local community in planting them, usually around 600 native tree saplings that are planted in dense clusters. It's called the Miyawaki method, and it promotes rapid growth. But they're not always welcome. There are some communities that say, oh, no, we don't want a forest here because that's going to be used by drug smugglers, or people will use it to stash weapons in some socially deprived areas. So there are these nuances which we need to take into account. But I take your point, yeah, that nature isn't always the silver bullet. And yet that's how we tend to talk about it in the conservation sector.
I was just looking through my notes now to see if there were any kind of topics. We had quite a robust conversation, but I wanted to see if there are any kind of particular areas that we missed.
We didn't speak much about indigenous people. And this is something that has really moved to the center ground. You were there, right, in Montreal recently?
The COP, yeah.
I wasn't there, but following from afar, and I saw how the indigenous voices were heard clearly. And in fact, they even interrupted, as a protest, Justin Trudeau's speech. And I think the following day, he announced a $400 million Canadian dollar package to support indigenous-led conservation, which was well-timed. But there is a conception, I think, a widely held belief in the conservation community that Indigenous people know best, and Indigenous people have and will always live in harmony with nature. And yet my experiences as a traveler, as someone who's worked on many, you know, expedition research projects around the world, is quite different. And I think particularly of the time I spent in Nepal, where I was looking at the park people conflict, so the conflicts between park regulations and indigenous people's livelihoods within Langtang National Park, and comparing it with the experiences of people outside the park. And honestly, the difference in biodiversity and ecological intactness was staggering. Inside the park was forested, and there was an abundance of life. Of course, there were some challenges for the indigenous people there. Sometimes their crops were raided by bears, by deer, and even monkeys. But generally speaking, the land inside the park was well conserved. And you took one or two steps outside the park boundary, and there was devastation. So there are many examples I've come across, and that's only one, where this romantic notion of indigenous people living in harmony with nature is, in fact, disproven. And I fear, although I don't have as much research experience in the field in Africa, but I think I've seen it, you know, anecdotally. I cycled across the continent once and passed through many game reserves, including nature reserves in which people, indigenous people, were living. And I can see that there are also challenges there. You know, it's not like they're living as their ancestors did 1,000 or 2,000 years ago. Now they have access to modern medicine and chainsaws and guns and all sorts of poisons and fertilizers, just as any other modern human does. Maybe it's restricted access, but they still can access it. And I think that there's a challenge there, and even a big question for us as conservationists. Are we being honest with ourselves?
So on the one hand, I think that theoretically, indigenous people living in their original state, for lack of a better term, with nature, could be and probably were in many cases truly living in harmony with nature. But then even in that case, there are some examples to the contrary. So for example, you probably know about the New Zealand example, you know, the fact that the Maori people before the Westerners arrived had already wiped out several species, including the moa, the large bird that lived at the time. Yeah, and a few other species as well. And so there are plenty of examples like that that were, you know, completely uninfluenced by Western civilization. Indigenous peoples living pretty much the way that they always had were certainly not living in harmony with nature. So, but I think a lot of the reverence that people give to, especially these days, it didn't happen in the past at all. So it seems like the pendulum has kind of swung perhaps a little bit too far the other way. But a lot of the reverence that people have for Indigenous peoples and local communities is, as you say, is kind of given without really having a very good idea of how those people live exactly, you know, and there are certainly things to learn from those people. I think this is the thing. This is what I mean by the pendulum swinging too far. Is in the quite recent past, we didn't give any credence or any respect to the knowledge that they had gathered, and they have learned a hell of a lot. You know, there are certain things which I think they can add to the canon that science cannot really add because it's such a different form of gathering knowledge. But the problem, which you put your finger on, is that we've swung completely in the other direction and to this point where anything that is labeled as Indigenous and local knowledge is immediately assumed to be unquestionable. And this goes back to actually what we were saying right at the beginning of the discussion, this whole idea of not being able to question, right? I don't think that ever leads to a good place. I think you need to be able to question, hopefully in a respectful way, but you should still be able to question. Nothing is holy, you know, or nothing should be holy.
Nothing should be holy. Absolutely. There's a lady I had the pleasure of meeting a couple of years ago, Julia Watson, who's written a book. She's actually a landscape architect, but she's written a book called Indigitech. And it's basically a beautifully portrayed series of case studies on how Indigenous people around the world are harnessing natural materials to adapt to climate change, or in some cases just to, you know, farm fish and food. And, you know, that there are bridges in India which are formed using the roots of rubber trees. And
I've seen that, yeah.
Yeah, beautiful imagery. Mm. Absolutely. And I think there is a real concern that these people who are not maybe commercially literate, one could say, they're wise and they're knowledgeable, far more knowledgeable than perhaps the modern Westerner is about the natural world, but they're not commercially literate and they are vulnerable to exploitation. And we've seen that in the past with the, you know, big pharma swooping in and stealing biological resources. And there's a big discussion in Montreal, I remember, about the DSI or digital sequence information and how to share that more fairly or in a fairer way with royalties or licensing requirements. Yeah. But yeah, coming back to your point, I agree entirely that nothing should be holy, and openness to new ideas is, I think, fundamental to human progress. Mm-hmm. And in this day and age, what we've seen is partly as a result of the social movements and the so-called cancel culture, I think what we've seen is a stifling of public debate. I mean, it's still raging at the extremes in these echo chambers, as you rightly pointed out at the start of the podcast. Mm-hmm. But I think the majority are feeling a little less at liberty to express their views than they might have done 5 or 10 years ago. And I'm talking about people like Tony Blair. I heard Tony Blair interviewed, and he was asked some very difficult questions about wokeism and his views on all manner of contentious issues. And he just said, I prefer not to comment on these issues because I think it's this is a landmine I don't want to step on.
Right.
And I think many people are, I mean, he's a former prime minister and still very active on the public policy stage. And if he's saying that, then how do the rest of us feel who don't have the policy literacy or, you know, the knowledge? I think it's very, very difficult.
Do you know Jonathan Rauch?
No.
He's a public intellectual who, so he's very much on the left. A lot of the people who are talking against cancel culture tend to be sort of right or center right, but he's very much a Democrat, but very much against cancel culture. And his main point in a recent discussion was that it's precisely what you just said, what Tony Blair did. What he did is precisely the problem. It's very easy to just say, you know, I don't want to talk about that, or simply not to talk. You don't even have to say anything, right? You just don't talk about it. people see what happens when some people do talk about things and how they can get themselves into trouble, and therefore they don't talk about things. And what Jonathan Rauch was saying is that it actually doesn't take very many people to stand up and say, you know, I'm sorry, you're wrong about that.
Yeah.
The tendency is for people to apologize. And they're apologizing to that very noisy, very small minority of people, and really sustaining what that small, noisy minority of people are getting up to. So he's a very strong advocate for standing up to that and calling it out when he sees it. So it's a pity to hear that Tony Blair did that, because he's someone who is in a position. It's just, you need a small critical mass of people to stand up against that kind of thing, I think.
And for someone like J.K. Rowling, sure, she can stand up. She has the financial means to take a hit. You know, she's not going to suffer. But for ordinary folk like me, I'm not going to stand up for my beliefs, knowing that I might get sacked or I might having my professional reputation sullied. I have to be very careful with my words. And I think all of us do. And that's the grip of fear, because the cancel culture is real and it's vicious. It's vindictive. And I do wonder about, you know, how we can fight back against this and do so in a sensitive way, because often, you know, the origin of these feelings or emotions is rooted in historical injustice or a minority group not feeling heard or not having rights or being disenfranchised. And we have to be sensitive to that. And often their arguments are perfectly valid. But the way in which these debates have unfolded in recent years, I think, has been frightening. It's been verging on fascism, actually. I mean, what is fascism? It's I'm right, you're wrong. You will not argue against me. This is how it's going to be. And that's how it feels at times.
It's about, fascism is about not being willing to have the conversation in the first place, right? It's the antithesis of free speech.
Funny enough, I was standing in a Georgian house not that long ago, and a friend commented on the fireplace and said, these are called, he had lived in Italy, he said, these are called fascius. And it was a bundle of twigs. And apparently that's where the name fascism derives from. A fascist, I think it's called in Italian, is a bundle of twigs tightly bound together. And the idea is, with fascism, it's the people that are bound tightly together in presumably one hell of an echo chamber.
There are two quite different topics that I have in mind for the next episode. One of them we actually touched on briefly in this episode, the fate of the world's corals, and whether that fate is as dire as some of the predictions make out. The other is ESG, environmental, social, and governance investing, which we mentioned in last month's episode. So two quite different topics, but both of great interest, at least to me, and hopefully many of you as well. Either way, I hope you'll join us.